This is Hitchhiking Off the Map.
Wasn't kind of an auspicious beginning. The food ran out. You know, by the time we got around, I think all they had was bread and salad. All the spaghetti was gone.
And I believe it's the source of our overconsumption of the earth and male-female power struggles and unhappy relationships and all
this. And now I'm trying to change the world by changing me.
And wound up in Chicago when September 11th happened.
I came away from that really marked.
And it was a hard ride for us. I mean, we'd been traveling all day. So it was a rough start.
I was always climbing up on things and falling off of things and trying to drown myself or get hung or electrocuted.
I usually have to hide out for a while. I look around and go, oh my God, what are these people doing?
I don't know what we imagined, but I guess we thought that it would be a little bit more together.
I would have thought so. I would have thought somebody in the world has it more together than I do. I think maybe we need advisors.
Hello.
Maybe a subcontractor.
From our studio in Sebastopol, California.
Or an intelligence agency. I mean, we have the Central Intelligence Agency, but I'm talking about intelligence, a cabinet-level department that advocates intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we're engaging in civic dialogue now. That might give aid and comfort to the enemy. Or all the enemies. How about an enemy of the month club? This is Conrad Bishop.
Hello. And Elizabeth Fuller, ducking for cover.
And Hitchhiking Off the Map is about journeys.
And we have a theme today, home.
Home, which relates to journeys because it's where we are going from or to.
The first story. Many years ago, we were on tour in the Deep South, and in Americus, Georgia, we stayed at Koinonia, a Christian agricultural commune, and we traded a free performance and workshop for a weekend's lodging and a crate of pecans. It was a deal. It's a radical Christian group, radical in the sense of practicing what they preach, and they were engaged in a housing program that became Habitat for Humanity.
Since 1984, President Jimmy Carter and his wife, Rosalind, have joined hundreds of volunteers in an annual building blitz for Habitat for Humanity. Scores of houses go up in just a few days for people who had been living in substandard housing. Several years ago, radio producer Paul Ingalls and his wife, Suzanne, spent their summer vacation wearing tool belts instead of swimsuits, and Paul produced a radio piece about their experience. So we're going to hear parts of that piece along with a recent phone call. It's about hugging the president.
I wanted to give Jimmy Carter a hug. Really, that was my main motivation for signing up to attend the week-long Jimmy Carter Work Project. And so I had this fantasy that if I went on this habitat build, I'd get the chance to shake the man's hand. But instead, I'd give him a big bear hug and say, "Thank you for all you've done. You're awesome, man." Or something like that, before being knocked to the ground by his Secret Service agents.
Well, we had been aware of Habitat for Humanity for many years and said, you know, we should do that sometime. We really ought to do that sometime. Could we do that? So when the Jimmy Carter Work Project in 2000 came to Georgia, including near Plains, we said, that's the one.
Anyway, off to Americus, Georgia, we went to try to hug the ex-president. A three-hour bus ride from Atlanta's airport deep into the heart of South Georgia dropped us off in a cattle barn at the Sumter County Fairgrounds with about 1,500 other volunteers from all over the country and all over the world. It was over 100 degrees inside, pouring down rain outside. Suzanne announced her mantra for the week would be, "I give up my comfort for the comfort of others."
But then we looked around, and most of the people at these Jimmy Carter work projects are at the Habitat Build, certainly getting the senior citizens discount at Denny's. And we just sort of said, well, if these folks can do it, let's suck it up. We can do it too. Let's stop complaining.
So at 7 a.m. on the first Saturday, we arrived at our building site, house number 15. We joined 28 other volunteers from all over the country, stepping up to the already poured foundation where our five-bedroom ranch-style house was supposed to appear by the end of the week. A guy whose name card said Dale appeared to be in charge, providing some direction in a Kentucky drawl. "Here's what we're going to do. We're going to line up those 2x4s for the frame and start nailing them together." Some people knew what to do, some kind of knew what to do, and the rest of us watched until we thought we could fake how to do it. Then we dove in with our hammers. Lo and behold, by the end of the first 10-hour workday, we looked up from our nail pounding, and there was clearly a house taking shape. Interior and exterior frame up. Roof up. Styrofoam insulation panels up.
So the woman whose family was going to be moving into the house was there with us, and she was helping in every way that she could. And about midway through the week, the house leader called a meeting of everybody and announced that the woman who was supposed to move into the house was having some problems with the bank because she had owed some money, and that if she couldn't pay it, she wouldn't be able to move into the house. So they proposed that our 30 people would pitch in to help her with this $1,000. And we'd already given so much, you know, frankly, we just were kind of tapped out in terms of our expenses. But I think we gave a little bit, as it turned out. And then late in the week, as they were awarding the keys to her house, it was announced that our crew had paid off her debt. And there was a lot of tears flowing then, and a lot of good feelings. Late in the week, it was confirmed that Jimmy Carter was in Georgia. He was working at one of those sites in Plains. So I made arrangements with the media folks to take me over to a press conference that Carter was having.
As I rode over to Plains, I thought for a minute about the last time I'd covered a Jimmy Carter event. It was, in fact, his inauguration in January of 1977. I was interning as a news reporter at a Washington radio station, my first real radio job. The news director was handing out assignments to his staff of reporters. They were all heading to the Capitol or the inaugural balls that night. Pauly said, right as Carter is taking the oath, they're going to ring the bells at the Washington Cathedral, and I want you to be there recording them. Well, if you know Washington, D.C., you'll know that the cathedral is nowhere near the mall where all the action was. So, at the appointed hour, I was standing in the snow outside the Washington Cathedral, holding a microphone up in the air, recording the bells as Jimmy Carter took the oath.
Would you place your left hand on the Bible and raise your right hand and repeat after me? I, Jimmy Carter, do solemnly swear.
I, Jimmy Carter, do solemnly swear.
That I will faithfully execute.
That I will faithfully execute.
The office of President of the United States.
The office of President of the United States.
While it did add a nice touch to my boss's inaugural story, I wasn't very close to Mr. Carter. Looked like 23 years later, I might get a little closer.
And they said, President Carter's working on that house over there. And I looked and looked and looked, and, you know, basically there's men and women, frumpy old guys in ball caps working on this house. And I couldn't pick out the former leader of the free world among them, really, until, you know, I kind of noticed that the media was trained on one frumpy old guy with a cap. And sure enough, that's Jimmy Carter putting aluminum siding on the work shed, and very intent, too, in his work. He was just obviously trying to line it up just right and do the job that he's very well trained to do. He's an expert carpenter. So I watched him work for a little bit and saw Rosalind was painting on the front porch.
After a while, Habitat Media folks set up a lectern and ran a caution tape line about 15 feet away from it, asking press folks to stay behind the line. My hope of giving Jimmy Carter a hug was fading. Jimmy Carter was introduced, and as he spoke,
thank you very much for coming this morning.
The 70s came flooding back on the unique wave of his voice.
So he made some remarks, and then they opened up the floor for a few questions, and I said, well, I'm at least going to get a question in. So kind of did my Sam Donaldson thing, you know, Mr. President, just be loud enough. So he had to look. And I asked some question that the folks at my house site had asked, and a couple of them said, well, when he's working on a house, what does he like to do most and what does he like to do least?
Well, I don't really mind any of it. I'm a fairly accomplished furniture maker, so the detail work really appeals to me most. I hate to say this here, but what I least like to do is to have press conferences.
So that was the big encounter. He did come by the house Friday or Saturday, but his advance team made clear to us at our house that You know, no one is to speak to the president or to try to slow him down or to take a personal photo or shake his hand because he's got 30 houses to do. So they want to make it businesslike. So I didn't try to accost the president. But I got, you know, a little bit closer to him. So it was kind of nice to be in his aura. And, you know, it obviously, when you finish a week like that, it's not, even though there was this kind of motivation about connecting with President Carter, really what's amazing is just that all those houses got built. A neighborhood of houses got built. There was nothing there on Monday, and by Friday, they were virtually finished, and finished to the point of where there's sod in the yard, there's landscaping. It's done, you know? It's really remarkable. I think the most impactful thing about the whole experience was talking about it with others when we got back. You know, because people, our friends knew that we were going to try to do this and they wanted to know all about it. But you sort of do get a sense that once you've had the experience, which is completely rewarding. I never worked so hard, slept so well, or felt so good about something that I've done in a long time. We've stayed connected and we're going to go again this year. They're back in Georgia in June. So after a couple years of forgetting how hot and sweaty it was, we're ready to try it again. But that experience along with September 11th combined, I would say, to inspire my wife and me to begin a project trying to develop a radio series on peace issues. And so we have a radio series in progress or in development called Peace Talks. And to just get on the radio some discussion about how to make peace, acknowledging that there's sort of a ripple effect. I mean, you can talk about peace in the Mideast or the war on terrorism, North Korea, things like that. Those are sometimes larger than life efforts at peacemaking, it seems. But there's a lot that all of us can do in our own families and in our own neighborhoods, in our own towns, that we felt didn't get talked about enough in terms of how do you do it. And we really do believe that there's a ripple effect, that if you can make peace with yourself and within your family, then things start to get better. So we have made some contacts with the Carter Center as we've been trying to line up prospective guests. We hadn't really heard back anything firm from them, but come the 20th anniversary of the Carter Center in 2002, we received a call from them. They were looking for radio people who would be willing to do short interviews with President Carter and get them on their local station. So one morning, evidently, President Carter was sitting in his office and they were phoning up local radio stations across the country. So I was up like at 5:30 so that they could call me at I'm in New Mexico and he's on the East Coast, so they were calling early. And I recorded an interview with him, 8 or 10 minutes, and of course that was very exciting for me to, you know, have a chance to talk with him.
And by the way, if you ever happen by 105 Hosanna Circle in Americus, Georgia, check out that mailbox in front of the house. That's my work. Not bad for someone who didn't own a tool belt 10 weeks ago.
We were talking with Paul Ingalls in Albuquerque, New Mexico. You can hear many of his other radio pieces on his website, www.paulingalls.com, and he spells his name I-N-G-L-E-S.
So, over centuries or millennia, a culture develops a technology of house construction. And then comes into play the economics of it. We know how to do it, but who's got the bucks? But then after all that, there's still the question of home. What is home?
Since we've been together, we've lived in 21 different places.
Yes.
But that doesn't count the hundreds of overnight places where we stayed, or the months or 2 months of living in some college guest artist apartment, or 3 months at a time in a tent.
Or a truck stop in the back of the van.
Sheba. Yeah.
Or staying up all night working at a theater and going to sleep center stage. Every one of those places, there are things I remember very vividly. And then other parts of the house or the outdoors or the neighborhood, I can't remember at all.
The heating pipes overhead.
The two doors to the bathroom that the cat sat on top of and fell into the toilet periodically.
Mirrors?
Oh, the fig tree. Oh,
and the fig bird.
Tall window and the brick wall. Oh, the duck.
The duck. The weeping willow tree.
My little study perch on the top of the stairs.
Where was that? Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The loose brick you could pull out and hide something behind. And our kids were about to kill us when we moved away.
So which of those are home? What does that mean for people?
So we asked.
Sometimes I'm doing interviews and I ask, what is home to you? What does that mean? Because if you don't know where home is, then how do you know if you're on a journey? Or maybe you're looking for home or something that feels like home, but do you even know what it feels like or just something you imagine? So I say, what is that for you? What is home?
What is home for me? That's a really complex question.
Home is where you hang your hat.
My apartment feels like coming home.
Home is where you feel comfortable and can settle down and be loved and share your love with others.
Comforting, nurturing.
Or when I went first time to India, I felt like this is coming home.
Safe.
First time I came to California and saw the other hippies, I went to 11 once at Big Sur. The Northern California and Southern California hippies came together and they were dancing on the beach. They were roasting a gigantic pig. And that felt like coming home.
I don't know anymore.
Be it ever so humble, there's no place like home.
It's tangled up so much with sentiment.
Home is the place where you have to go there. They have to take
sense of loss, nostalgia.
Father, dear father, come home with me.
Heads for home improvements.
So it's home again and home again, America for me. My heart is turning home again, and there I long to be, I long to be, I long to be, I long to be.
What does home mean? Well, home to me, I think, is where my wife is and where the dogs and cats are.
Oh, my. Home may become the back of a panel van at some point soon.
It's really in transition because it used to be, I come from an old nobility family with, on my father's side, 900 years of heritage awareness. I grew up with a sense of a home as a castle, as a physical place, and then everybody lost it after the war, and so there was, and then I was born in Africa, and we had to leave that home after 6 years, and then it was Germany. I never really felt at home there, and then for a while it was the home with my children, and now I don't know anymore because there is an awareness growing that the home is more inside of me. Sometimes I'm more at home at a wood or on the ocean, so it's gotten a bit complicated.
Some place I will create. Because even here, I mean, we've created a beautiful apartment, but it's not home. Buffalo's not home. India, I like the joke about is home, but I know really it's not home.
So home is something I'm thinking about a lot because I have to move.
I have two homes here in Tel Aviv. I mean, now I have third home because I go to Romania too. So from no home at all at the age of six, I have three homes now. So what can I complain?
So home is an aspiration I have, I think, that one day I will create a community. And we just know you've created this community of people and you know that you're with your own, you know. That's what I think about with home.
My home is not a place. It is people.
And people just people. Disappear, people. Go off into...
A house is made of walls and beams. A home is built with love and dreams.
And dreams, the way you're in a room somewhere, very familiar.
His heart hath ne'er within him burned. As home his footsteps he hath turned.
Nobody walks home. You fly, you drive, you take the bus.
To market, to buy a fat pig. Home again, home again. Jiggity, jiggity, jiggity.
Open arms. And it means being with us together. Calmly. Our house that we're sitting in right now, it was a tiny little Forestville cottage, so small that Naomi's wheelchair wouldn't fit at the kitchen table, so we've done a remodel to open it up. It's more open plan, more airy, more spiritual, more windows, more wide doors, and so forth. And as a family, we've talked about our external home being a reflection of our internal home, of our hearts, of our spirit. And so we still, with every meal, even this morning, in the rushed breakfast before school,
We don't do this every morning. I lie, you know, at breakfast table, taking a time to all hold hands. That's home. That's part of what home is for us.
We fantasized America and we dreamed it, but for me, the sense of home always happened when we were going back to the Philippines. And to this day, I don't know any place here in this country. There are places I love, but there's no place I call home here. And I'd always dreamed of going back there because that's always what I've thought of as home, but it's not there anymore. It's just not there.
Ideally, home is a country where you understand that you have freedom of speech, of assembly, where your phone and your email is not tapped, where uniformed policemen and people in plain clothes don't ring the bells of your neighbors and say, would you like to talk to us about your neighbors? So that would be home, my dear. That would be home. My skin is my home. That's where I live. And in this world, I've carried it all over. I've traveled in North Africa. I've traveled in India, thousands of miles in India, on my own, right out there on a limb, riding the buses. I've met all kinds of people in this world. And what I've found, wherever I've gone, is that everyone has an amazing intelligence if you will just listen. If you will just listen. That, for me, is home. It is a government that listens. It is people that listen and that don't talk so much. So maybe I should be silent now.
Show me the way to go home.
Home to
go
me home. Is a sanctuary.
A sanctuary.
Far from the old folks at home.
Home is my heart.
It's comfortable. It's soft.
Oh, give me a home where the buffalo roam.
Home's inside me.
Cozy, clean, fresh.
Well, the question that I've come up with recently is, why are you running?
For the first time, I'm living alone for the first time ever in my life. And this feels very much like home.
Back home in my community and you call my name, I have friends who know me very well, who know where I used to go and what I used to do. And that's what makes you a part of the people.
So many houses and so many grandiose type places and hovel type places.
I'm a Taurus. That's a fixed earth sign. Home is very important to us. We lived for 15 years in a little three-bedroom cabin on the Russian River. You know, and the cabin itself was really kind of funky, but I planted roses all around it and all kinds of flowering plants, and the inside was just, you know, had beautiful and mystical things everywhere, and books and music and light. But in 1998, I decided to travel, and I packed everything up in boxes, and I'm not unpacked yet. And I'm living in somebody else's house in a little bedroom. And this is really strange and new and upsetting to me, because home is where, you know, I'm able to fully express who I am with the decoration, with the people that I have over. And when we lived on the Russian River, we had livestock in the house. We had our pet chickens, and we raised little baby goats on bottles in the house, and they slept with us in the bedrooms, not in the bed. But we had a household with as many as 30 different non-human animals living with us in the backyard or in the house. You know, reptiles, rodents, you know, mammals, birds, you name it. We had it at one time or another. And it was a lovely, lovely multi-species household.
And it's a little after midnight now. And I've been listening to these voices and starting to wonder, what would I say if I were interviewing myself? Outside, I'm surrounded by great beauty when the sun comes up. The office where I'm working is cluttered with three computers and stacks of paper and the tangible records of our life. And I have declared this to be home. How bizarre even to be asking the question, what is home? Would people on other continents in other millennia torture themselves with this simple-minded question? What's home? Well, right here. Simple as that. Is the real question, what do I need? Where do I belong? Who am I? Who cares? Those terrible questions of the 20th century lagging over to the 21st. What do I need? Where do I belong? Who am I? Who cares?
And home is that place that you can rely on.
I mean, when Dawn went back to her mother for a while, then when she came back to us, the room that we had built for the girls was only 8 by 11. And they said, of course there's room for Dawn. So we put 3 girls into an 8 by 11 room. And 2 of them were teenagers. If you need to be there, there's always room for you. You're not going to go hungry here.
You were listening to Home. The voices you heard were people we've talked with before. Mark Gold, Mimi Begin, Arturo Castillo, Catherine Walker, Elizabeth Johnson, Ula Menzel, Rocky Rockwell, Joy Wolfwoman, Moshe Yasur, Laurie Roth, Sam Reynolds, Lorna Catford, Steve Willite, Cecile Pineda, Carol Vanek, Gail Blum, Mary Tressa Farnham, Joan Schumann, Cody Kirkham, Martin Fuzzi, Betsy Yeager, Diane Darling, Karen Mortensen, and us.
So that's our trips for this week. Hitchhiking Off the Map is produced by The Independent Eye with funding from the National Endowment for the Arts and the California Arts Council.
And we'll be performing live in the area, too, so visit our website and send us your email address for announcements, www.independenteye.org.
And if you're in the area and have time and skills and would like to volunteer, we can probably use you. Office help, computer, special events, promotion. Send us an email and help us keep sending out the signals.
Next up, we look at a journey toward truth.
What a trip. A woman looks into the mirror and confronts a liar. And a job interview supervised by Demosthenes.
Tune in. This is Elizabeth Fuller.
And Conrad Bishop with a couple of thoughts on journeys from Friedrich Nietzsche. Along the journey, we commonly forget its goal. Almost every vocation is chosen and entered upon as a means to a purpose, but is ultimately continued as a final purpose in itself. Forgetting our objectives is the most frequent stupidity in which we indulge ourselves.
And from John Steinbeck, a journey is like marriage. The certain way to be wrong is to think you control it.